Welcome to Trinity Radio with Dr. Braxton Hunter and Professor Jonathan Pritchett.
The gospel teaches that Jesus is the only way to God.
Many ways, many paths to what you call God.
I don't believe in your version of God.
Whatever we once were, we are no longer a Christian nation.
The Trinity Crusades Radio Program.
We're all gonna rise.
Welcome to Trinity Radio. I'm Braxton Hunter, and along with me is
Jonathan Pritchett.
We have been gone for 2 weeks. 2 weeks since our last show.
Tell them why. You've told everyone else on Facebook.
So I have been suffering from adult chicken pox. Our pastor at church asked me, do you need some Hello Kitty Band-Aids or something? Because kids are supposed to get chicken pox. Let me tell you something, friends. And those of you who have had it know, if you have adult chicken pox, it is one of the most horrible experiences you can have.
Shingles.
Right, not shingles. People are getting confused saying, oh, you had shingles. No, shingles is the same virus, but you can't get shingles till you've had chicken pox. And if you've had adult chicken pox, this is one of the most horrible experiences without having a terminal illness that you can have. But anyway.
And Dr. Braxton Hunter is sporting a beard to cover the fact that his face for the last 2 weeks was falling off.
Yes. And if I do say so, Jonathan, you and I both look a bit more scholarly with our facial hair. But
yes.
Mine will be gone.
I grew a beard because I'm ugly, but you grew a beard to cover up.
Well, to cover up the horrible chicken pox that were making me ugly. It'll be shaved off by the time I come to a church near you. I just can't shave it off now because I'll cut those chicken pox open.
Is incomplete for me to do a show without Dr. Braxton Hunter. So
That's right. We do it together. So let's talk today about we're going to have the first word, last word. For those of you that don't know, I might as well go ahead and say this. We've got some new listeners, Jonathan. Sometimes you might hear us introduce a topic, and then the next thing you hear is something completely unrelated to that topic. Yeah. And the reason for that is because we do what's called the first word and the last word. And that's a chance for me and Jonathan to each talk separately and apart from being interrupted by the other person. So we have that. But today, after that first word, we're going to be discussing science and how science has been influenced by postmodernism, we think. Not sure I've heard many other people say this in a broad, sweeping way, but you're getting it here.
Our postmodern ideas.
Yeah. So just stick with us and you'll find out everything that's wrong with science from two non-scientists.
This is the first word.
What is the one good reason for loving God? It is because He first loved us. If a man marries a woman because he wants her body, it doesn't matter how beautiful she is. One day his desire for her will fade. Similarly, if a man loves God because of what was done for him at Calvary, his gratitude will fade. What's the one thing that will keep a man in love with his wife? He's got to love her just because she loves him. If it's anything else, that relationship will not last. The same is true of your love for Jesus Christ. Why do you love him? Why Jesus? Let me ask you a question that I think will put this in perspective for you. If you knew that there was no danger of hell, no hope of heaven, no reward and no punishment, no reason to love Jesus other than just because God told you to and He brought you together, would you love Him anyway?
And now, today's topic.
And we're back. That was the first word. Thank you, Jonathan Pritchett.
Yeah,
as we talked about earlier, we're going to talk about postmodern ideas in science. And, of course, Dr. Braxton Hunter and myself, we don't claim to be scientists. But that's actually a good thing for us to criticize science in some areas from the outside. Because they don't do a lot of self-governing anymore. Peer review is not self-governing because you have peer review, which which checks the data, right? And the findings and the conclusions and all that. But what they don't do is they don't ever self-govern their presuppositions.
Well, this is the problem and why it's okay for the two of us to comment on science, even though we're not natural scientists, like you say, is because what we're really criticizing today is how philosophy is used by scientists.
Or not.
And, right. and how they bring philosophical concepts to bear on their work, right?
Oh.
And it's also important to mention that philosophy and theology, as I've said before on this show, used to be considered sciences, and natural science was the least important of the three sciences. And so some of the tools that we use for investigating history, theology, philosophy are the same ones that we use for science, some of them. And in fact, one of those is what we're going to talk about today with one of these scientists. Sean Carroll, Jonathan, you're familiar with Sean Carroll. He had a debate with William Lane Craig. And as it stands right now, as far as I know, that was the last live public moderated debate that Craig had. And William Lane Craig being one of our most well-known, preeminent Christian debating apologists. But they debated the subject of the beginning of the universe, cosmology, and all of that, and whether God exists. And Sean Carroll, this is his field. And so it was a good debate. I mean, I really do think you're in a different camp than me, Jonathan. You think that it's possible Craig has lost a debate. I can't point you to a debate that I think Craig has lost, and I've heard all of them. But I do think this Sean Carroll debate was really close. Not because I think Sean Carroll was right, but just because William Lane Craig's not a scientist.
Yeah, form, not content.
Right, right, yeah.
Performance.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
And so, but having said all of that, Sean Carroll was recently on NPR. And I happened to be driving to Nashville, and the only radio station I could get had NPR on it, so I was listening to that. And you notice how I kind of just had to apologize for listening to NPR?
Yes. Anyway, well, we have a lot of Republican listeners.
Yeah, so so I'm listening to NPR, and here comes Sean Carroll. I'm thinking, well, what? This is so interesting. I turn up the radio because I'm thinking, I'm about to hear Sean Carroll, this atheist guy that debated Craig, talk with a friend of his, and they're talking about a new book they're writing, which I can't remember the name of it, but it was all about how certain principles need to die off in science. We don't need to just try to bear with things, or maybe in the future they'll bear out or something like that. Now, there's some things we just don't need to even leave open the possibility for. They're just these things have been demonstrated to be false. We need to get rid of them. Or principles that are holding back good hypotheses, right? Okay, so Sean Carroll's big thing is multiple universes. And Jonathan, you're familiar with the idea of multiple universes.
Yes.
Now, for those of you philosophy junkies out there, we're not talking about possible worlds. That's a different thing. But multiple universes. Now, you're going to hear a lot about this and probably already are on pop culture, like shows like you were talking about, Jonathan, the Big Bang Theory sitcom. Yeah. You'll hear multiple universes talked about there.
The multiverse.
Multiverse. Yeah, that's another way of saying it, kind of shorthand for it. And you'll hear about it on a lot of these things and on the news. And, because right now, that is a very popular thing for middle-class, upper-middle-class, wealthy Westerners to talk about and try to sound smart. And it's also a popular thing for scientists to try to find funding for. And this is what Sean Carroll's doing. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, Jonathan, but you go on NPR saying that other hypotheses need to die off so that yours can be more celebrated. You're looking for funding.
Well, you're looking for fun. For one thing, it's about money. But two, this is what I was talking about. There's no self-governing on the presuppositional level anymore, because those of us in apologetics, we can view the multiverse as a anything but God argument that's used for. I mean. Mm-hmm. And Sean Carroll, tell him what his claim was.
Okay, well, before I get there, let me just bear out what you just said.
Yeah.
When you hear this in pop culture about the multiverse, they usually will not bring up the discussion about God. They try to present it just as a new scientific theory or a popular scientific theory, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, there was a Facebook thing going around that the Big Bang is over, and
right.
You got new stuff. Yeah.
But here's the reason that this theory exists, is because our universe is incredibly fine-tuned for life, Incredibly so. And this is not just a theologian claiming this. Stephen Hawking admitted this in The Brief History of Time. He said, it's just amazing how well-designed the universe seems to be. Richard Dawkins admits that. Most of these atheists will admit, yeah, it is extremely unlikely that this universe would be this finely tuned by itself if it's the only one. So the answer Christians want to give is, well, it's finely tuned either because of chance, necessity, or intelligent design. Well, it didn't get this way by chance. It didn't have to be this way, so its physical necessity is out. So an intelligent designer designed the universe. Well, what Sean Carroll and guys like him want to do is look for a naturalistic explanation for why the universe is so finely tuned without God. And so here's the point of the multiverse. If you have trillions and trillions of other universes, then the chances that one of them will be like ours, will be life-permitting, increases dramatically.
And then, whoa, we should, you know, it solves the anthropic principle thing.
Sure.
Where, whoa, we can observe the universe as observable because we just happen to be the ones in it,
right,
and the one. But since
there's trillions of other ones, one of them's going to be this way.
Right.
Don't feel special. Now, of course, this still doesn't explain where the multiverse came from to begin with.
Right.
That's the cosmological argument answers that problem. But so what I'm telling you is this multiverse issue is not just some new benign theory that's out there. The fact is this arose, despite what anybody else tells you, as a way of avoiding the conclusion that there is a God. That's what's going on. Now, they'll dress it up and say, well, we could never say God because we're scientists, we're dealing with the physical universe, we can't give you a supernatural conclusion. But again, they don't have to. It's like William Dembski and all these intelligent design guys say, you just say an intelligent designer and then leave it up to the person to determine whether that's God or whatever. But the bottom line is that's the point of the multiverse, right? So you might be asking, well, what's the evidence that there's multiple universes?
Math.
Yeah, but even there, like
math and entities,
math that is based upon the supposition that there might not be a God, or that there's not a God.
Well, that's not what they'll say. What they have is models, and then mm-hmm. they posit entities like dark matter mm-hmm. and this stuff, and they give things phenomena and names so that they can mm-hmm. arrange it and try to make sense of the universe. Why do the things we know about appear the way they are? Well, and what do we not know about? Let's give that a name, even though we don't know what it is. We'll give that a name, and it'll function as a placeholder, so to speak. You mm-hmm. know, you talk about God of the gaps. There's science of the gaps everywhere, you know.
Sure.
And there's you know, people working on things like dark matter, that most of our universe is dark matter. What is dark matter? Okay. So right? So you got all these things. But what you have is you have everything's constructed in mathematics. You have these elegant mathematic models, and as long as the math comes out, it becomes a plausible representation of the physical universe.
Right, but what I don't want our audience to be confused about is, you're right, they are using math as the evidence, but what they're saying, what they're doing with the math is, let's determine how many universes there would necessarily be for you to get one like ours, which you can't do without a basis of comparison anyway.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, even the math isn't evidence. It's just you imagining something,
yeah,
right? So bottom line with all of this is, so Sean Carroll has really no evidence for this. No, none of these guys have it. There's no evidence of a multiverse.
Physical evidence.
Right. So, well, even philosophical evidence.
There's philosophical evidence to refute it.
Right. So
no evidence for it.
So there's no evidence for it. So here's the question, or here's what Sean runs into all the time. So Sean Carroll gets this question. Well, what is your principle of falsification for this? Now, I tried to explain this the other day, Jonathan, what falsification was, because it comes up with a lot of things in philosophy and history, and it's one of those things that crosses these different fields. But let me explain basically the principle of falsification. And I'm realizing now that this is probably going to end up being the most boring podcast we've had in a long time, unless you're just really into this stuff like we are. But falsification is a worldview, a historical fact, a scientific hypothesis, whatever it is.
Philosophical construct.
Is more plausible or should be accepted more readily if it can be falsified. Now, that doesn't mean if it's false.
Right.
That means you're giving me some way that if it were false, I could demonstrate that.
Right.
Right. So let me give you Christianity, the Christian worldview, for example. something you're familiar with. The Christian worldview is falsifiable.
Which is a good thing.
Right. That does not mean it is false. It doesn't mean anybody's ever going to prove it false. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with it. What it means is we're willing to say to skeptics, all right, if you want to show us that Christianity is false, we're going to give you a way to falsify it. And here's the way. Produce the body of Jesus Christ. All right, that's one thing. People have tried to do that. Remember a few years ago, the ossuary box they found in Israel, and we've got the body of Jesus, and it turned out to be that something else. But the bottom line is, if you showed us the body of
Jesus, God doesn't exist. No question,
or if you showed that God doesn't exist, right, you would have falsified Christianity with one of those two things. So we've given you a way to falsify. Take gravity, for example. Theory of gravity is a pretty credible theory, right? Yeah. Well, if you showed me something that fell upwards, all things being equal, not because it's a kite, it literally gravitationally fell upwards. Okay, well, maybe that would falsify something about gravity. So you come up with this as a way of saying, okay, you're making this claim. What would it take to demonstrate that your claim is false? Well, when people say this to Sean Carroll, they say, show us what it would take to demonstrate that the multiverse is false. And he doesn't have a way. Well, what that tells you is he doesn't have any evidence. Because if he had actual evidence of the multiverse, or any of these scientists, besides just their own imagination of what it might be like, it'd be super cool if there was a multiverse.
Yeah.
If they had any actual evidence, well, then they could show us a way to falsify that or show that the evidence, that they're misunderstanding the evidence. So what Sean Carroll has said is, let's just not worry about falsification anymore. Maybe we should just throw falsification out the window. Maybe you should. In other words, what he's saying, to put it in very simple terms, in layman's terms, is I want to make my theory such that you can't ever show anything wrong with it. You can't ever poke holes in it because I'm not giving you anything to demonstrate it.
Right.
Right.
But you should believe it anyway.
But you should believe it anyway because I'm a scientist and I'm really smart.
Right.
Right.
It's like that sign that we saw. See, scientists, we were at a Star Wars thing.
Yeah.
Of all things, at a museum.
Me and Professor Pritchett.
And our wives and kids. We all went to Star Wars. And for some reason, even though Star Wars is science fiction, there was a little table there.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little Darth Vader statue. And it had Darth Vader was holding a sign that says, "We're scientists, ask us anything." Like, anything.
That is weird. Darth Vader's not a scientist.
No. And it's science fiction. Why would you want scientists at a science fiction thing, right? But it's a museum, so whatever.
All kinds of irony going on.
Right. But the premise behind it is that scientists can be asked anything because they're experts on everything now. They're the bastions of all knowledge.
Yes.
And of course, that's ridiculous.
It's the same reason that you pointed out when we did the show on the meaning of life with Neil deGrasse Tyson. The little boy asked Neil deGrasse Tyson, "What's the meaning of life?" Why would he know the meaning of life? Oh, because he's a scientist. Yeah. And even though the meaning of life has nothing to do with science,
right?
Oh, well, you know, he's a scientist, so he knows everything.
Yeah, he can give you the meaning of your bowel movement and a physical description of it.
Well, he can't even do that because he's a physicist or a cosmologist.
Well, true, but I'm just saying that might have some sort of higher meaning to some
sure,
people.
Right.
But, I mean, that's not... That's different. That's a function. That's not meaning.
Right.
So scientists have claimed this for themselves for some time now. And in my Apologetics 2 class, Braxton Hunter teaches Apologetics 1, and then I come behind him and teach Apologetics 2. And in our class, you would think after listening to my lecture that I hate science. And I don't. But I'm not afraid to criticize science because science is not the bastion of all knowledge, nor is it even a source for all knowledge. And a number of things come to my mind. Number one, I like to make a distinction between scientists and engineers. Scientists can make useful discoveries, but engineers take useful discoveries and make useful objects. And so I'll hear atheists say,
This is all coming from your love of Lego.
Yeah, Lego is awesome. But I'll hear from just on the street atheists or Facebook atheists or YouTube atheists, you know, we have medicine and iPhones, so you should – and because those work, you should buy into science.
More than supernatural stuff.
Yeah, your religion and blah, 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 you know. And I'm like, yes, I love my iPhone, and great. But an engineer made that. They made me something useful. And I love vaccines, and I'm glad scientists are working on that. But there is a great chasm you have to jump over to go from, because I have an iPhone and a vaccine for chickenpox that Braxton Hunter never got, therefore, everything science wants to tell us is true, and everything else that is told from other disciplines is meaningless.
Especially considering the fact that one could simply rebut that religion and religious people gave you most of our modern institutions of science.
Indeed.
So just like science gave you the iPhone, well, we gave you science.
Well, but engineers gave me the iPhone. Right. And number two, it bugs me to no end to see scientists claiming to be bastions of knowledge of everything and then tell us that there's only real knowledge in one category and that everything else isn't even knowledge.
Right. And the claim that, you know, there's this thing called self-referentially incoherent things. So like the claim, this sentence is not true. Well, if you refer it to itself, it doesn't work, right? And in the same way, the claim that science is the only purveyor of truth is not a scientifically defensible claim.
No, it's a philosophical
right.
But now
right.
Philosophy has been tossed under the bus.
See, sure, yeah. And literally, like Stephen Hawking says in his book that philosophy is dead. It's gone. Even got him in a lot of trouble with all his friends in the philosophy department at his school. But he's saying philosophy's gone. Listen to us scientists.
Right.
And he writes a philosophical book.
Right. It's a book of anti-realist philosophy.
Yeah.
And so now you have, let's get rid of falsification. Let's embrace anti-realism. And Lawrence Krauss in a debate with William Lane Craig.
Well, explain what you meant about that, about the anti-realism with Hawking. Because we talked about that before the show, but what that is? What is anti-realism?
Well, it's just, I guess, in layman's terms, to me, it's a choose your own adventure kind of thing,
right.
You know. So it kind of goes back to a little bit of. I don't want to get too deep into anti-realist philosophy, but essentially, if you think this way, you can make it work. And if you think that way, you can make it work. So let's stop trying to have, all these things compete with one another, and let's stop trying to prove one another wrong. Just leave it all alone, because it's choose your own adventure, essentially. So for Stephen Hawking, he comes up with his model for the cosmos, right? And what does he say at the conclusion of the grand design? This is it, because it's it. It's tautological.
But you're right. The anti-realism is when you deny objective reality.
Yeah.
And so if Hawking is willing to go that route and basically say that, well, then why are you writing a book telling us how
the
universe is?
Well, it's the same thing Alex Rosenberg was going through with his philosophical position. He's commenting on science. If science gives us an accurate representation, anything we say about it is therefore meaningless, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's right, but his position is absurd. And I think anti-realist philosophy, because when you deny objective reality, that which is beyond, so choose your own adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it could be, could be this, could be that. But if it's that for you, it's fine. It speaks more to this trend in science with Hawking, with Carol now saying, mm-hmm. why do we need falsification?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Lawrence Krauss who told William Lane Craig, well, if what we turn up as scientists doesn't mesh with reason and logic, well, it's so much for logic.
Yeah, but the problem
with
that is,
if 2 + 2 = 5, then if that's what the universe tells us, then we'll have to live with it. Now, he says the universe doesn't tell us that. But if it did, then so much for logic.
Right.
But see,
he's giving you a supposition. But
right.
the problem is, how could you determine what science is giving you without logic?
Sure.
Right?
And how can you distinguish? Why should we believe Stephen Hawking's model, the grand design, which was circular? Because gravity exists, the universe can and will bring itself right. into existence
the problem
from
is
nothing.
That you've already got space,
gravity,
time, gravity. Energy, a balance of negative and positive energy. Gravity is a force.
Right.
The universe already exists.
Because you have gravity, it'll come from nothing. Well, gravity ain't nothing.
It's kind of like it reminds me of the old cartoon.
I mean, the non sequitur of 2010 was from Stephen Hawking, right?
Well, it reminds me of the old cartoon where the atheist scientist says to God, I can make a man just like you can make a man. And he's like, well, then show me. And he says, okay, all I got to do is get some dirt and some water. And God's like, get your own dirt and water. I made that dirt and
right.
water, right?
Right. But you see, number one, Carol says, don't try to falsify this. It's getting in the way of good science. Mm-hmm. But number two, because anti-realism is now being embraced, we have no idea how to detect good science in the first place.
But the bottom line of all of this is, so, science is trying to science is manipulating philosophical principles to avoid the God conclusion. And all of these guys are presenting themselves as the only purveyors of knowledge. You know, it occurs to me now, they're not really saying science is the only source of truth. That is what they're kind of saying out in the open. But really, they're just saying, we are the philosophers now. We're the philosophers, we're the scientists, we're the atheologians. Atheist theologians, and we're going to tell you everything from all of these fields because we're scientists.
Right. And it doesn't matter that you end up with contradictions, like
right.
anti-realism and then believe us because we're scientists.
Right.
Now, wait a minute. We can't falsify this. We can't prove you wrong. You give us no method to demonstrate you're wrong. We should believe you, you know, just on fideism, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, within your own, own set of governing principles, which they have almost none now, why should we believe you when we can choose our own adventure, right? So we should believe you even though you tell us we have no reason to out of the other side of your mouth. And then we can also, you know, toss logic out the window if it gets in the way of research, right? So you've got anti-realism, no more falsification, and if logic and reason get in our way, we can chunk that too. And then what are you left with? You're left with something that looks a lot like postmodernity.
You know? All right, so we've covered all this scientific stuff. Now I'm going to ask you a biblical question because, Jonathan, and maybe no one will ever hear this because they won't wade through the Sean Carroll talk, but we had a listener write us in and ask us this question. He had just listened to our Problem of Evil podcast, and Ben Robertson says, just got to listen to this today. I love the podcasts. I'd like to hear you take on this thought. When I think of tragedy, I'm reminded of what God said to Adam in Genesis 3:17. Cursed is the ground for your sake. Could it be that tragedy and suffering is actually the force that causes fallen man to actually seek God?
Now, that's an interesting question. The seek God part of the, and then the for your sake, because the for your sake, that's a soul builder theodicy, right? Mm-hmm. That now to seek God, which no one ever does, but could be, you know, I don't know. Sorry, man.
Well, we can say this with some certainty here. One of the ways that we answer, and we didn't really discuss this in great detail on the podcast, but one of the ways that Christian apologists answer the question of why suffering exists, why a loving God would allow for suffering, is what is called, Professor Pritchett just mentioned, the character-building theodicy or John Hick's soul-making theodicy.
Yeah. I just put the two together.
And the character-building, they're kind of the same thing.
Soul-building.
He made a big deal about that they're not the same thing, but they're kind of the same thing.
They're kind of the same. Sorry, Hick.
The character-building theodicy says, and Scripture absolutely indicates this in Romans and in Peter, 1 Peter. But the idea that, yeah, your suffering does make you into a better person, that God does use suffering.
Yeah, and Dr. Clay Jones from Biola, in his theodicy, it's one of 7 points in his theodicy. It's not the 1 point. It's one of 7.
I agree with that.
It's part of it, but it's an incomplete picture.
Right, and that brings up an important point. If you don't know what we're talking about with the word theodicy, or if you don't know what Professor Pritchett just said, just go back and listen to that show that we did on the problem of suffering, because we explain all this stuff. But a theodicy is basically an explanation of how God is just in light of there being evil in the world, and he's supposed to be a loving God to allow evil. Right. So I said, and Professor Pritchett, you agreed too, that the reason there's evil and wickedness in the world ultimately is because God decided to give man free will, right?
Yeah.
But there are other points too. Like you just said, your professor friend had 7 points to his theodicy. Yeah. And if you broke mine down, there are probably more points. But basically, I think that evil and pain exist in the world and suffering because God gave man free will. And
that's
used
Dr. Jones' first point.
It's my first point, too. I think that is the engine, so to speak, that stands behind all this. And then secondarily, I do think Scripture clearly teaches that God, even though I don't think that God is the source of the pain and suffering, God uses it to make us into better people,
yeah,
to purify us.
So if that's what Ben meant by to seek God, well, I think that would work for believers who understand a biblical framework of theodicy, right? Mm-hmm. That for our sake that we would seek God, that the ground be cursed and we have to toil and all that. Sole reliance on God, is that a way to lead people to God? I would say no, but if it's a way for us who recognize God, and, you know, regenerate persons to rely on God as a result of the fall and look to the new heavens and new earth, absolutely. So I don't know if that helps, but
well, other translations of this translate Genesis 3:17 thusly. To Adam he said, "Because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you." Cursed is the ground because of you, rather than for your sake.
Yeah, but whatever translation he's using, I think he was just simply asking a more philosophical question from the thing. Why, you know?
Well, I think what
would this be a part of it?
It's certainly a good discussion. I wonder if what he meant by that was when it's because it reads in his translation, "Cursed is the ground for your sake." It almost sounds like it's saying for your benefit. Yeah. But I think that the better way of understanding this is that the ground was cursed because of what Adam and Eve did.
Right, but what he was, what I took him to be asking was, is there, whatever his translation's merits aside.
Right, regardless of that, does evil tend to lead people to
right,
God?
And what you said that yes, God uses it in that way, but but then he added, you know, and so that we could seek God.
Well, that's just a speculative thing in terms of evangelism, right? Yeah. The question of whether a person might come to God because of suffering, you're saying, yeah, I don't know about that. And
well, without special revelation.
Right. You're saying as just a general revelation, like they might look at the beauty of creation and respect the designer, but this would almost give you the opposite. On the other hand—
And has for a lot of people.
Right, sure. There's a lot of atheists today, and they are atheists. Though they may give you all these arguments and stuff, the reason that they're an atheist is because something horrible happened to them and they are mad at God. Yeah. We are in the building right now with someone who recently accepted Jesus Christ. And after a time of saying he was an atheist, and it turned out in the end that a big part of it was just something bad happened to him, you know. But I think God can use all things ultimately to draw people to himself. And you look at a story of someone like Joni Erickson Tada, who jumped out of the boat as a child and broke her neck. And she talks about the blessing of her disability. She's learned so much about God from it. Was there special revelation there too? When we say that, what we mean is, did someone give her the message of the Bible itself? Yeah, probably. But certainly her tragedy made her who she was.
Yeah, I mean, God can use all kinds of means, and if you think of redemptive history, and you think of creation first, then the fall, well, God still had Christ slain before the foundation of the world, so there was always an end to this. So, in my thinking, God knew what he was doing, even in and through the punishment, because in that same passage, you know, the serpent's head gets crushed, right, and the seed of the woman. So you have the proto-eugalion there in Genesis 3 as well. Mm-hmm. So God's always got in view. So to Ben's question, regardless of the translation, is that a factor? And I say yeah, and I think it's part of the what we would call the character building or soul building, the right. Odyssey. God can brings that about in our lives, and First Peter is a good book to do that. Romans 5 kind of gives you a character building the Odyssey with the Holy Spirit. You know, so.
But also too, you know, those the fact is that sometimes pain and suffering, or the fear thereof, does lead to an embrace of the Christian message. You know, there's no atheist in the foxhole statement, you know, that sort of thing. Someone gets a terrible illness. I have a personal friend who I went to high school with who is an atheist today and was raised in a very Christian environment. And and the sad thing about it is he remains today very rebellious against the Christian message. Now, I don't want anything bad to ever happen to him. But if it is the case one day that he gets cancer or some other disease or someone close to him dies or something like that, and that is what God uses to humble him and bring him back to himself, then I think that that will be a sad way for a good thing to come about. So to answer your question, Ben, we've kind of gone a little further into it than maybe what you were hoping for. But the truth is, yes, God can use that. God can use anything in creation to bring people to himself. And we believe, as Professor Pritchett and I both pointed out, particularly from Romans and 1 Peter, that God does allow for evil and in part brings character building aspects out of those things.
Right. This is one of the things I try to talk a lot about. You hear about God's wrath and punishment. You know, it's for your sake, you know, or because of you, however you want to word that. It's because Adam sinned. There's a result. There's a consequence from it. Right, but I have to remind people, even especially getting back to Romans 9, you know, that foundational passage.
Man, you love Romans
9. I love
9.
It. It's one of the best chapters in all of the Bible. You have to remember that when we talk about what God's doing and what God is, what are his attributes, you know, justice, wrath, you know, love, mercy, grace, etc. God's judgments and the consequence of sin, even in a chapter like Romans 9, is always aimed at mercy, right? So even and if you skip to chapter 11.
You got a writing project coming out about this,
right,
don't you?
Yeah, we're going to keep a lid on that. But the even the partial hardening that came to Israel, as we find out in subsequent chapters after chapter 9. So what was the point of that? The point of that judgment, just like it was with Pharaoh to deliver the Hebrew people, it was to include the Gentiles in it. So even in cursing the ground, you have the promise of the seed. You always have mercy in view when there's judgment. So judgment comes, yes, but God still has an ultimate end, even in that, to extend mercy and justice and grace and truth and
absolutely
love and all that. So, you know, we got to keep all of that in mind. We can distinguish between God's attributes and God's expressions, but we have to keep them also tied together from the biblical arc of what it's all aimed to. So when you think about evil in the world, you have to keep that in mind, that God works through all things after the counsel of his will. Now, contrary to some interpretations, that doesn't mean everything that happens is his will. But God is at work. It's present tense in Ephesians 1:10. You know, God is working everything after the counsel of his will that has an ultimate end for those in Christ. So, you know, we can take comfort in that. And that knowledge, I think, far surpasses the knowledge of unfalsifiable multiverse theories.
That's right. So. Well, we'll end with that, Professor Pritchett. But let me say this. I'm an evangelist with Trinity Crusades for Christ, traveling and preaching that people might be saved. But we are sitting right now at Trinity College of the Bible and Theological Seminary, and we want you to become a part of our school and learn how to defend the Christian faith, how to counsel people, how to proclaim the truth, preaching, how to pastor, and we want you to do it with us. And that we're not just saying that because we want to line our pockets or anything like that. We're saying that because we think it is laughable, isn't
yeah.
it? We're saying that because
Dr. Braxton Hunter and I will never get rich because of Trinity. We promise you that.
But we are doing that. We are saying this because I happen to believe, I was thinking about this, Jonathan, that I was telling Dad this, that in big part because of work you've done. We're a better school today than we were a year ago, and we're going to be a better school this time next year with programs we've got coming in the future than we are right now. And this, to me, is the place to go for theological education. I mean that with all my heart.
I do, too. I mean that with all your heart as well. No, I think you're right. And one of the things that we want to emphasize to people is there's all kinds of things. I know that a lot of our students, they don't, when they come to Trinity, they don't come to Trinity just to learn, even though the learning is top-notch. They come to learn and put it into practice. Because one thing that separates us from a lot of seminaries out there, and I don't mind saying this and patting ourselves on the back for this, is that we want the ministers of the Lord to be busy ministering. Mm-hmm. We don't want to just fill your head with esoteric theology and apologetics right. and counseling and stuff.
Don't let the beards fool you.
Right, and become an absolute ivory tower, you know, contemplative, worthless person, you know, right. where you don't do anything. We don't want to produce eggheads. We want to produce busy eggheads. So, yeah.
So and with that
functional
being said,
eggheads.
If you're not even wanting to be a professional minister of any kind, maybe you're just a lay person. You listen to this show. You know, you can go further. Don't you want to know as much about the God that we serve as you possibly can, and how to serve Him better? Well, we have a lot of lay people that go to school here too, and we want you to be one of those if you're a lay person.
Yeah, we
so
do.
Whoever you
because our education is affordable, you know, we do attract a lot of lay persons. So
right.
you don't have to be called to a vocation, though you may find that calling in the process of your learning. Because how would you know if you don't spend time in it and stuff? But
right.
if you have even the slightest inkling that you want to be heavily involved in ministry, Trinity is the seminary where you learn the information you need to know so that you can go do the things that God would have you do.
Dr. John Brooke, our founding president in 1969, created this school with the desire to do two things. Number one, provide an education that ministers could take part in without leaving their ministry field. That really didn't exist at the time, especially not the way we did it and do it now. And then number two, he wanted to provide that at a low cost. And to say that we're competitive with other schools of this caliber is putting it far too mild. And so...
if you audit one of our webinars, you'll find out that, contrary to this podcast, Dr. Braxton Hunter and I are actually smart in some ways.
Well, hey, and by the way, send us in your questions just like Ben did. Let us know what you think. Like our Facebook page and keep listening to the Trinity Radio Show.
This is the last word.
From my book, Blinding Lights, the first book I ever wrote, I want to provide you with a list of the prophecies about Jesus that he fulfilled. He will be in the family of Eve. He will be a descendant of Abraham and a relief to the world. He will be of the tribe of Judah. He will be a prophet like Moses. He will be the Son of God. He will be resurrected. He will be specifically crucified. He will be humiliated and mocked. He will be pierced through hands and feet. Though he will be crucified and beaten, his bones will not be broken. Men will gamble for his clothing. He will be accused by liars. The Messiah will be hated without a cause. He will be betrayed by a friend. He will ascend to heaven. He will be given vinegar and gall to drink. Kings will respect and worship him. He is a stone the builders rejected, who will become the chief cornerstone. He will be a descendant of David. He will be born of a virgin. His first miracle will be in Galilee. He will heal the blind and deaf. He will be scourged, humiliated, and spat upon. The gospel according to Isaiah. People will hear and not believe the arm of the Lord. He will be rejected. He will be killed. He will silently listen as he is accused. He will be buried with the rich. He will be crucified with criminals. He is part of the new covenant. He will be our advocate. He has a dual purpose. He will arrive at a specific time. He will be born in Bethlehem. The Messiah will return to Jerusalem upon a donkey. He will be sold for 30 pieces of silver. The disciples will forsake him. He will authoritatively return to the temple.